Well, Mr. Howell might as well stay here because he is going to read the paper for Mr. Dunham on the Gray's occultation expedition and results. So I think we'll just have John go ahead and take that paper right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Equipment specially designed for observing Gray's occultations. The importance of Gray's occultations observing has posed many problems for the observer, as several disappearances and reappearances quite often occur within a minute. The United States Naval Observatory designed and built a special cable with connections at intervals of 400 feet, where an observer could be stationed, and with a tone generator, he could signal the central recording station each time he saw a star vanish or reappear. The recording station is monitoring a time signal continuously, so that every signal from an observer is recorded automatically against the time signal, and a tape can be replayed later, and the observations analyzed completely. Each observer on a cable has a tone generator that has its own individual tone frequency, so there is no trouble in identifying which station made the observation. At various Gray's occultation expeditions, somewhere between 50 and 100 observations have been successfully recorded. This sophisticated equipment has now been built by several amateur astronomical groups in the USA and successfully used. In California, the Riverside Astronomical Society, the Santa Barbara Star Cluster Group, the Mount Diablo Astronomical Society, and also the Milwaukee Astronomical Society have observed Gray's with their own cables. Expeditions to observe Gray's occultations. Mr. Thomas Van Flandern and the author led a group on April 23, 1966, to observe a Gray's of 13 Tauri near St. Hyacinthe, Quebec. 74 timing observations were recorded. On August the 12th that year, I led a group to observe a Gray's of the fifth magnitude. The first person, by the way, is the author, David Dunham, not me, when I say I. On August 12th that year, I led a group to observe a Gray's of fifth magnitude 125 Tauri near Castaic, about 50 miles north of Los Angeles, close to where the first Gray's was observed, using my predictions in 1962. Stopwatches, tape recorders, and shortwave radios were used to obtain about 55 timings. Reverend Ronald Royer made an interesting observation using his 12.5-inch Newtonian reflector, the largest telescope in the expedition. For a few seconds after 125 Tauri disappeared, a faint star of about ninth magnitude remained visible. Similarly, the faint star reappeared a few seconds earlier than the fifth magnitude star. A similar sequence was observed as the lunar mountains hit the star two more times. Reverend Royer timed all these events. Judging from his timings and observations made at adjacent stations, the faint companion must have been about 3/10 of a second of arc north of the primary. 125 Tauri is a spectroscopic binary with a period of about 28 days. The ninth magnitude star that was observed could not possibly revolve around the primary in such a short period, since 3/10 of a second of arc corresponds to about 60 astronomical units at the primary's distance from the Earth. It probably is a previously undiscovered third member of this system. It was also seen by James Young at the Table Mountain Observatory about 50 miles away, as he observed and timed the event as a normal ordinary occultation. A similar report was given to me by members of the Mount Diablo Astronomical Society. During the northern limit Gray's of ZC1436, three of the most experienced observers noticed that the star took a second or more to disappear, indicating a possibly previously unknown faint companion. About 2/3 of the observers were stationed too far north and observed a miss on this occasion instead of the Gray's. Another Gray's of a double star, Gamma Virginis, early in January 67 was attempted using the United States Naval Observatory cable equipment. Several observers started making timings of it a short distance north of New Haven, Connecticut. In spite of good observing conditions, many were unable to see the two 3.6 magnitude stars against the moon's sunlit limb. Two of us who saw the stars during the graze soon became completely confused by the two stars popping in and out among the rugged lunar profile. The Milwaukee Astronomical Society obtained about 96 timings, probably a record, during the graze of the 7th magnitude ZC-1089, the morning of September 10th, 66. Their sophisticated cable equipment is discussed in an article in the January 1967 issue of the Sky and Telescope. Members of the Riverside Astronomical Society in California decided in September 1966 to observe a graze in their area on November the 19th. The local telephone company gave them about a mile of salvage drop cord, and they spent about $50 on tone generators and other miscellaneous items to make their cable. A tape recorder, shortwave receiver, and a small diesel-powered generator are supplied by club members during a graze expedition. The cable was hastened to completion for the first two grazes on following nights, but improper wiring of tone generators caused total failure. The trouble was corrected in time for the graze the next night, and 41 successful timings were recorded. Only a few timings were made at the first graze by one observer using an independent means. 11 stations used the cable to make timings the second night. Comparison of the results with a limb profile prepared from Dr. Watt's charts show the moon was probably south of its predicted position by about 3/10 of an arc, a second of arc, and that the observed timings came about 10 seconds, corresponding to about 3 degrees of position angle, earlier than predicted. This is rather typical for a southern limit graze occultation. During November 1966, no less than 7 grazes were observed and over 200 timings made. 3 were observed the night of November the 4th and 5th, one near Odessa, Delaware, and the other 2 from Knox Corner, Maine, where the 2 graze lines intersected. The 2 cables built by the United States Naval Observatory were used for the 3 grazes. The stars were Upsilon 1 and 2 and 28 Cancri. About 66 timings were made of Upsilon 1 at Knox Corner and 60 of Upsilon 2 at Odessa. The Santa Barbara Star Cluster Group have built their cable in 400-foot sections so each observer can connect on his own length. This makes it an easy and a quick way of laying out and recovering the long cable. The tone generators are built into telephone receivers, and on September 23, 1967, they made 49 timings of the graze of ZC-460, although there was tremendous static from nearby overhead power lines. The ability of the observers was also demonstrated by the fact that this particular graze was only classed as a marginal one. The microphone in the receiver enables each observer to communicate with all the other observers along the cable, and this is very helpful for testing and giving instructions and briefings. The cable is about a mile long, and they hope to extend it later on with more wire discarded by the telephone company. Some electronic difficulties are still being worked out, but the cable has been successfully used to obtain other timings on 2 grazes that following winter. November 1967 Saturn occultation. Elaborate plans were made by about 60 amateurs from several Midwestern societies to observe the grazing occultation of Saturn last November 12, 1967. They were joined by astronomers from as far away as Yale and the United States Naval Observatories. This is described in the Sky and Telescope, January 68, on page 58. They formed into 2 main groups after meeting at Sabetha in Kansas. One group, under the direction of Thomas Van Flandern, set up a 6-station line of observers spread over about 2 miles near Nemaha in Nebraska. Peter Espenscheid and I led the other group and used the United States Naval Observatory multipoint cable near Dawson in Nebraska. A few other amateurs led by Robert Sandy set up at Bern in Kansas, where some of them obtained photographs of the event. At Dawson, I watched the disk of Saturn disappear completely, but the eastern edge of the rings remained visible. A few minutes after the disk was covered, its edge appeared for a few seconds through a lunar valley. 2 minutes later, the planet began to emerge from behind a lunar limb near mountains at the southern cusp. A similar sequence was seen at the other stations along the line. Timings were made of contacts of the lunar features with the rings and the disk and the intersection points where the Saturn's rings appear to touch its disk. The Van Flandern group at Nemaha were farther inside the partial occultation zone, and they witnessed the complete disappearance of planet and rings. The southernmost observer there also saw the tip of the rings gleam very briefly through the same lunar valley that we saw the disk edge appear through at Dawson. Results from analyzing the observations. Mr. Van Flandern has been analyzing these grazing occultation observations made during the past few years. A large periodic variation in the moon's latitude with an amplitude of nearly a mile and a period of a draconitic month has been discovered. And this implies a correction of several seconds of arc to the longitude of the node of the moon's mean orbit. A recent examination of the meridian circle observations of the moon support this result. There appears to be other significant latitude variations, and more grazing occultation observations are needed to study them. Reductions of ordinary occultation timing seem to yield a somewhat similar variation in the moon's longitude. Predictions of grazing occultations in your area or ordinary occultation predictions for your location will be supplied upon request. Expanded ordinary occultation predictions are now available for observers interested in timing more of these events. David Dunham, Yale University Observatory. I'll show the slides now and have questions after. This is the last slide of a sequence of a grazed photograph by a member in Kansas. But we reverse them and run through properly. Repeat the clock again. Well, the whole series would be backwards if you put them in the way I gave them to you. That's correct. This is my observatory here in Calgary. It's a 10-foot diameter dome. Next slide, please. This is the equipment. It's a 10-inch Newtonian. The copper telescope is a 5-inch refractor, wide field, and there's a small 3-inch F8 tracking reflector alongside. It's an M17 elbow telescope for a finder. Oh, went the wrong way again. This is Hirschmanso, Sussex, or Greenwich Observatory in England. This is the moat round Hirschmanso. These slides were sent to me by David Dunham, by the way, from Yale Observatory. This is the gardens at the rear. You can see the dome at the over the trees there, one of the major telescopes there. This is the United States Naval Observatory main building. And this is the computer center. Is the focus all right? I'm rather close here, I can't see. This is the computer center where the lunar occultation predictions are derived and sent out to the observers. This is a lunar profile. There's one outside I made for this graze of Jupiter through Newfoundland in October, and the ellipse or curve there is the mean standard limb, and it's been elongated 15 times to enable this profile to mean something. And as you can see, the limb features are either below this mean limb level, or in places they come above the mean level. But it gives you some idea of the rugged features that the track of a star say the star is about here as it comes into the field of view. It would probably just miss this mountain and then vanish behind this one. You might just see it appear here, disappear again and reappear in this gap, and disappear and then reappear here and finally pass clear. This is the reductions made by Thomas van Flandern. I'll read the caption below. Thomas C. van Flandern prepared this diagram to show the events of the grazing occultation of the star ZC398 on February 19, 1961, as observed from 10 stations in California. These sites were spread over 2.55 miles, roughly along a north-south line. Each row of dots marked the computed path of the star past the moon's edge. And the dots are the path of the star, as seen by the observers. It's lost in place, but plotted so that the ordinate in the excess of the angular distance between the moon's center and the star over the moon's mean radius. When the star was visible, the dots are joined by lines, and they are broken when it is hidden by a lunar limb feature. The dashed curve is the moon's profile as predicted from C.B. Watt's charts. Note that the observed disappearance and reappearances tend to come earlier than indicated by the profile. United States Naval Observatory diagram. This appeared in the Sky and Telescope some months ago, or possibly a year or two ago. This is Americans coming north, crossing the Canadian border to observe the graze at St. Hyacinthe, Quebec, described in David Dunham's paper. This is the Trans-Canada Highway, I believe, in that area. Not very sharp. This is where they laid their cable, I believe, alongside this highway to make the observations. They're unloading equipment here prior to setting up to observe the graze. Here's the station mark. I think they use a spray bomb to put the letter in the number in the gravel there. You can see the red number 5. And the cable is the red line running up my edge of the screen here. This is the wooden spool they wind the cable on, and unwind it, of course, when they want to lay it out to take up stations. The spool marks the station point for the observer. This shows the plug connection, I believe, for the tone generator they use to signal their observations in. And here's the observer with a tone generator operator in his hand. This is David Dunham making a grazing occultation observation with a small refractor. He looks quite comfortable, doesn't he? This is the Riverside Astronomical tone generator equipment. They're housed in small boxes. And I guess the lid. I don't know anything about this equipment myself personally. These slides were sent to me by David Dunham, and I haven't had a chance to go through them before screening them now. This is the station site of the Riverside Astronomical Group. They drive in these 2x4s apparently with a number on, and you can see the cable laid on the ground with the connections made for the observer to send his recordings down the wire to the central recorder. Here's the spool they wind it on, and here's the number 10 station, I presume. And there's the observer by the look of it with his tone generator in his hand. This is a small diesel generator to supply the power for the electronic equipment. And here's their central recording station equipment, radio and tape recorder. This is the Riverside Astronomical Group. Cliff Holmes, the organizer, is at the right. So we can identify Cliff Holmes. He's in the dark suit. This is the United States Naval Observatory Group preparing for the Saturn occultation in the Kansas area. I don't know any of them personally. This is a sequence. This is taken by Stan Warkaczewski of Kansas City with a 16-inch reflector. It's of 88 Virginis, magnitude 6.6, August 64. Now, which of the two cusps of the stars, I don't know, but we'll have to watch the movement. This first slide was 8:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. The second slide is 8:34. I can see two at the lower cusp and one at the upper cusp. Aha, we've lost one at the lower cusp, I see. That's 8:35. And now there's a double one at the lower cusp. That is 8:39. That must be the reappearance. Thank you. Have the lights, please.
Would you be prepared to answer any questions on Mr. Dunham's paper?
If possible.
Are there any questions on this last paper?
Idea was that each observer was equipped with his own radio, own stopwatch, a possible assistant to equip with other watches, and a tape recorder. This means a tremendous amount of equipment by each individual. Here in the Calgary Center, some 12 of us at different times, not all of us at the same time, but We've had as many as 8 out on marginal grazes, 8th and 9th magnitude ones that I derived from the occultations I received from my telescope. And some of these are predicted as a miss, and the computer hunts around a 100-mile area for the graze path. And it gives me a series of latitude and longitude coordinates. I can establish a rough idea of where the graze path is. And we've tried 4 or 5. And apparently the farther you get away from the standard station, which in this instance is my telescope, the less accurate the coordinate becomes. And we've never actually observed a graze with these faint stars. We're only doing this actually as a prelude so that when we do get a brighter star graze, we'll have some idea of the problems involved. Primarily with the faint ones, we're finding that if you haven't got a slow motion gear on your telescope, you're generally in trouble, especially if the moon is more than half sunlit. To answer your question about convincing a telephone company to discard cable, I've given up in this province because it's a government-owned telephone system, and I'm not taking on the government. But there's many other sources, I think, of cable. I think my most hopeful source of building a cable would be from the oil companies, especially their seismic crews and that, who use a considerable amount of cable, I believe. But I think any enthusiast who is out to build his cable will find cable somewhere. And even if it's only in 400-foot lengths, I mean, this is what you want. I think the one group who described their cable with the telephone receiver seems to be the most compact idea. The others were 1,600-foot cables, I believe, in the United States Observatory built, and some of these other groups. And they have huge reels and this sort of thing, whereas if you can build it in 400-foot lengths, you just give the one reel to the one observer and say, well, here you are, out you go. And the first guy at the site, he just sets his station up, unreels his 400 foot. The next guy comes and plugs into him and unreels his 400 feet. And I'm hoping this year, as a late centennial project, you might say, to try and have a cable rigged up here. There again, it's another piece of equipment, and if you've done any occultation observing, you'll find that just handling your telescope, because after all, you're dealing with a moving object, and normally you've got high power on it, so a small field of view, and you're attempting to keep that bright moon out of your field if possible, and well, I mean, you're using one hand on your slow motion for a start. You've probably got a stopwatch in the other. Well, you can have the walkie-talkie on your neck, I suppose. but you're going to do so many things at the same time. And I think this is the idea of trying to cut down the amount of equipment the observer's using. If he's just sat there, he hasn't got to worry about radio or anything else, just the one thing in one hand, press the button every time he sees an observation, and he can make a statement to the fact that it's a disappearance or reappearance. This is recorded on a central tape recorder and is there for analyzing. Okay.
I'm afraid we can't entertain any more questions on this section. If you'd like to see Mr. Howell afterwards of any particular question, but we have to get on with our program. Thank you very much for reading this paper for Mr. Dunham.